Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I'm joined by Steve Atkinson, EVP at Buckingham Strategic Partners and an expert in practice management and the evolving role of the financial advisor. Most importantly, when I asked my boss, Eric Clark, who I needed to have on the show, Steve was the very first person that popped to mind. So you come highly recommended. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Daniel. And it's an honor to have Eric make that recommendation. Hopefully I can live up to his expectations.
Yes, no doubt. No doubt that you will. I'm seeing the Huskers football in the background, and I'm wondering if this was a partisan choice, seeing as you are both big Cornhusker fans, but we'll allow it anyway.
Suffering fans stick together, apparently.
We will allow it. Yes. Yes. So, Steve, thank you for coming on. I listened to some of your work in preparing for this podcast, and you had this great thought experiment that I wanted to recreate here. You asked folks to think about all the advisors that they know, right? And for someone like me or someone like you, that's going to be hundreds or even thousands of advisors. But then you ask them to winnow that field and say, who would you want to work with, your parents or your spouse if you passed away and things like that? And you say the field narrows very quickly, and that when people are making that narrowing, it's always narrowed on behavioral factors. Now, we work in a field where advisory awards are given out almost exclusively for things like asset growth and AUM and size. And yet, when it comes to whether or not an advisor is trusted, it's almost always a behavioral consideration. So you have a podcast, you've done research into what sort of behavioral considerations make someone a trusted advisor. What have you found?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. And to your point, I'll do this quite a bit. A lot of times within the industry, people that serve advisors, et cetera, to your point, I'll ask them in dozens at a time, and I'll say, how many advisors have you crossed paths with? And if you spent a lot of time with them, you know really well. And that number will be, you know, in the hundreds, if some cases thousands. And then I'll ask, you know, to your point, if you have to make a recommendation to either hire that advisor yourself or with your family, your parents, or someone you really care about, it gets like, they can count them on one hand, right? And I'm like, wow, you cover a lot of advisors who are probably good advisors. They probably have good businesses, but there's a difference between, you know, maybe your point on the industry awards and, you know, raising assets, adding clients, and then actually people that know them, whether they hire them or not. And when it comes to the word trusted, I think that's it's a tricky word, because trust can mean different things to different people, right? So I can trust you to make a recommendation. I can trust you to execute a tactic on my plan. But then there's a different level of trust. I would actually trust you with my life and my future and my family and things like that. And some of the things that when I ask everybody that narrows it down, some of the things they always talk about is kind of how the advisor goes about their business when other people aren't looking, right? So it's one thing to be on and be in game mode when the clients are there. But what's interesting is when you're working with people that, you know, you go out to lunch with them or you're meeting with them in their office, and maybe they treat their staff differently than when they treat their staff when a client's present. Or it's things like that that you don't see, like behind the scenes, that, okay, this isn't a person that I don't think they represent the values I have. So it's things like that, right? Following through on commitments, reaching out when they're not expected to reach out. You know, it's things along those lines that I think ultimately build the trust where you're willing to hire them give them that huge responsibility of handling something for yourself when you see the full 360 view of how they engage day to day with people.
So we're both authors, and my wife only recently got around to reading my next to latest book. She still hasn't read the latest book. So she recently got around to the 2 books ago, and she said her favorite part of the book was there was like a 10-part checklist for how to choose an advisor. And it was interesting to me. That wasn't, to me, an especially interesting part of the book. But she said, look, you know, if anything ever happened to you, I would really need to know how to thoughtfully choose an advisor. Now, I love everything that you said, but it also occurs to me that the average end investor is not going to be privy to how their advisor or a potential advisor treats the concierge at the hotel or treats the server at the restaurant, even though that's good information to have.
Yeah.
How, from the outside looking in, how can we make a determination about whether this advisor is going to be that handful of advisors that other advisors would trust to their parents or their spouse?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's probably a couple of categories I would, you know, let's say you have, and this happens all the time, right? We see this where there'd be a couple and maybe the advisor focuses on the dominant person in the relationship, the one that talks all the time. And there's always that unspoken other person in the party, the other spouse, whether it's the husband or wife or whatever it might be. And there's almost an assumption that they're going along, but quietly, they're like, I don't connect, right? And so, I think some of the categories there that if I were in a relationship and I was vetting an advisor, I would look at like how do they give feedback, right? So something an advisor does every day is they're giving counsel or feedback to their clients on, hey, do this, don't do this. Here's how I'd handle this. They're giving feedback to their staff on things. So, you know, how do they give feedback? And is the feedback empowering to you? Or is it something where like you're being told to do something, you know, and it's how they do that. A couple of examples could be, do they let the client speak first and provide their thoughts, which is an easy thing to do. So what if the client agreed and they spoke first and the advisor's like, I have no problem with that recommendation, right? Then now they're actually endorsing the client's actions versus always, you know, feeling like it's their job to speak first and give that advice and counsel. So that's one area of, I would say, how they give feedback. And again, if you're in a relationship with an advisor and you're rarely engaging that advisor because there's the dominant spouse is always doing the talking, that would be an example of like, they don't even ask me for my feedback. Right. And I rarely feel connected. So that's one. The complexity of how they communicate is another thing that we hear about. So, you know, this industry is filled with tons of jargon, right? Titles are changing. What we call ourselves change. You know, I think Airbnb now is a wealth manager. 10 years ago, we were, you know, and maybe an investment advisor. And it always gets sexier and sexier because we like it the way it makes us sound. But to a client, they're like, you know, you ask most clients, they're like, oh, are you wealthy? And they're like, no. I'm like, actually, you are. But they just don't use those terms. Yet we call ourselves wealth managers. So like, you know, how plain spoken is the language that they use? Do they feel like they're trying to appear like they have more information, they're smarter than you, or can they relate to you on your level and in terms that you think about and wake up every day thinking about? I don't think the average client wakes up thinking about standard deviation or correlations or, you know, trusts or risk management. I mean, those are industry terms. Mm-hmm. And some of the best advisors speak in terms of family, you know, protecting your assets in the event of X, Y, and Z life events. And that's how I think people, when we communicate with each other or we have those thoughts in our own head and wake up at 3 a.m. and go, oh my gosh, what if this happened? It's usually not in terms of industry jargon. So the best advisors, those most trusted advisors, tend to simplify their communications and messages and they're very present around making sure that they're not appearing like in a parent-child relationship. Like, I just know so much, I'm going to impart my wisdom on you, and it's so complicated, that's why you're hiring me, type of a thing.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, there's an inherent power differential in a client-advisor relationship, because presumably the advisor is the one, the keeper of the, you know, the keys of the financial kingdom. But you don't have to maximize that power differential. You don't have to accentuate the power differential. If anything, you want to minimize it. That was one of the things that I wrote about too. So I'm glad to hear that I'm in good company. You know, you do a lot of thinking and writing about the changing role of a financial advisor. And I'd be interested to hear, you know, first of all, where do you think we're headed? Because it seems like we're increasingly veering into things non-financial, and sure, that some of the work of a good advisor these days borders on what formerly might have been the purview of, say, an executive coach. So I'm interested, you know, in part A of the question is, where do you think we're headed? And part B of the question is, how do we communicate that value to the investing public when the investing public still largely thinks of us as stock pickers?
Yeah, which is, I guess, frustrating if we have clients that still think of us as stock pickers. It's a complex question you're posing there, Daniel. And I'll start with, you know, the comment around, you know, this idea that the advisor holds the keys to the financial kingdom. I don't know. Do we? You know, we've all got iPhones. We've got access to the same information. Maybe 25 years ago, that was somewhat relevant because the average client didn't have access to all that information. It wasn't at their fingertips. But today, you know, so I use that as the backdrop to where I think the advisor role should be migrating towards. I think it should be migrating towards a relationship where, assuming the client has the same information as you do, what would you be giving advice on, right? So now you're not giving them new information. I always say you're more of a coach, or you're a catalyst to the advice to the client. It's your job to foster a conversation where the clients are asking questions, maybe about something they've read, heard, they're thinking about, they're concerned about, they want to capitalize on, which those type of conversations. And by the way, I think every advisor does this to some degree. I would argue that everybody can always get better at it. But a good conversation when you're talking about all those things, the curiosity of a client should result in probably at least a dozen different topics that the advisor that can then, you know, either compliment the client on what they're already thinking, introduce some ideas that the client can vet. You know, in this day and age, rarely do people make a decision based off of one person's advice, right? I mean, look at the social nature. We're going to bounce ideas off our social network or our friend network and say, hey, what are you doing? What are you thinking? I recently talked to an advisor and she said her job is two things, and she works with the ultra high net worth. There's two things that her clients hire her for: to be honest with them, because most people that surround people with money aren't that honest because they want to agree with them. And the second thing is to fill them in on what people like them are doing from a financial standpoint.
Yeah.
Right. So it's less on, you know, giving direct, here's the answers, the keys of the kingdom, and more about how can you change your approach where you are fostering conversation and the client is just opening up and talking probably 90% of the time. And then you're throwing thought provoking ideas or questions to them to pique that curiosity and eventually, you know, run it out. So they either take action or go, you know what, that was a rabbit hole. I'm not going to even focus on that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. So if the investing public still doesn't grasp this changing role, though,
yeah,
you know, there was research a few years back from Natixis, and it looked at the delta between how advisors felt they added value and how clients perceived that value. Yeah. And it was like 80 something percent of advisors said sort of emotional coaching, behavioral management's the number one value we add. And only 6% of clients agree.
Yeah.
How do we bridge that sort of enormous chasm between what the research suggests we do, which is indeed very valuable, and how that value is perceived by the people we serve?
Yeah, I think it's just continuing or starting to actually do it, changing our language that we use on our websites and our communications. And you're already seeing it. You know, we work with a lot of advisors, and the advisors that continue to get introductions and are growing their practice by meeting new people are demonstrating these behaviors. So I think at some point in time, those type of advisors just went out, whether it ever makes mainstream communications and perception. When you ask those clients and do surveys of those clients, they're making those introductions because they feel a higher degree of trust or they feel like the care that the people they're going to make the recommendation to are going to be handled in a consistent and in a high class manner. That you see some studies where why don't clients refer? And it always surprises me that one of the biggest reasons they always say is, my advisor is just too busy. I don't want to burden them with, the time. And because, how many clients will sit in the waiting room for like 5 minutes, right? And they're like, what does that show to the client? You're just so busy. Right. And it's like, and the advisor's like, no, I got plenty of time. It's like, well, you better, show up on time and not look so busy to your clients. But I think a lot of us, we want to look busy or appear that we're just, we're so active and whatnot. But
it's so fascinating because I think based out of insecurity, sometimes we try and appear busier than we are. We try to do things like speak in jargon rather than meet someone at their level. And what I'm hearing from you is that as all of these things are sort of inadvertently sabotaging the way we go to work and creating distance where there ought not to be any distance. Take the flip side of that coin. What have you seen that really knits clients and advisors together? What are some actions that advisors can take to really build that connection? Because I, listeners of this show will know, I really pound the table on connection being the thing that facilitates advice that sticks. It's that trust, it's that connection is the thing that builds advice that sticks. So what are the variables that are predictive of that being close-knit?
Yeah. So before I jump on and answer that, I want to, go back to everything we're talking about. I mean, you can do opposite of all of this and still raise a lot of assets, right? Hence all the industry awards on, top producer and things like that. Well, you can be very persuasive and charismatic. That doesn't mean you're trusted. Now, we also know that clients are highly influenced, right? If they feel a connection at the moment and they feel a higher status, like, ooh, I'm working with the big advisor and they're so successful. So therefore, and then once you've got them, we also know it's really hard for clients to leave. They don't want to have that conversation to leave. So I want to say that because, I think where you're going here, what we're talking about is, okay, how can you build a very successful practice and actually have true relationships where clients are raving fans of you? So I think the things that make things, knits it all together, if you want a raving fan of a client, you need to be a raving fan of them. Hmm. Right. So what things are you doing consistently that demonstrates to your clients that you're rooting for them, right? You're a raving fan of them. And there's a lot of things we've learned behaviorally that do demonstrate that my advisor's rooting for me every single day, right? They don't need to talk to me every day, but based on how they go about their business and how they interact with me or those I'm close to, I feel like they're a raving fan. And that alone will help, will encourage clients to take more action. Right. Who doesn't want to, give back to a raving fan? Right. So the other big thing I think is just accountability. Right. So it knits it together. There's, we always talk about, I need to get my client to buy in, or, I need to get someone to buy into the idea. And when we're doing planning, there's a lot of different strategies that ultimately need to get executed on. Now, we also know through research and studies that a lot of inertia happens, and a lot of times clients don't take action. So we're always studying, like, how can we bridge that gap? What you're talking about, to actually get clients to take action. And we kind of say, well, number one, don't get them to buy in, because that's, if someone's buying in, it's not their idea, it's someone else's idea. And so how do you get clients to take ownership of the action, right? So when we own something and it's our idea, we're more likely to take action on it. So, and I think to get ownership, it starts with the conversation, right? So how do you get the client to talk? How do you get them to come to a conclusion of what they want to get done? Even talking about the time frame they want to get done. Like, how, when you wake up at 3 a.m. and this is a topic on your mind, how often are you waking up at 3 a.m.? Do you want to have a good night's sleep? Or how painful is this topic right now? But you got to have them come to the conclusion on their own. So it's their idea. And then your job as an advisor is to set expectations, set accountability so they achieve that and get that off their plate.
So I love this idea of, in order for your clients to become raving fans of you, you need to be raving fans of theirs. And I'm going to draw on my experience as a clinical psychologist a bit here and say, people are always a little shocked when I say this, but I really didn't like some of my clients, and this is something this is something that's a little bit embarrassing to admit because these people are coming to you for help. They're having a hard time. And there are certain people I would see on my calendar and just kind of like, ugh, like, you know, yikes. Like, right. that's going to be a tough hour. But I'll tell you what, Steve, if I had that reaction, it was a signal to me. I knew I couldn't serve them well. I knew I couldn't be an effective therapist and have that attitude. It was a signal to me that I didn't know them well enough. Mm. Because I found that when I knew someone's whole story, when I knew someone deeply enough and understood their behaviors and their motivations at a fundamental enough level, even that something that's sort of socially grating or obnoxious in the moment took on a new light and a new dynamism, and I understood them better, and then I was able to become their raving fan. So I think it's worth owning that not everyone is perhaps equally likable, like sort of at first blush, and yet we can become raving fans of just about anyone, I think, if we spend enough time with them and we listen hard enough.
I'd agree. And you're, we also have to be honest with ourselves, right? So you got to take clients on that where there is that reciprocity of wanting to be in that relationship. At the end of the day, you're in a relationship as an advisor and a client. And if you don't, you know, have that passion to be in the relationship, is it fair to the client that you're in that relationship? Yeah, I know the money's great, but yeah. You know, to your point, if you're seeing that client on the calendar going, oh gosh, how are we going to cover an hour's worth of time? We just don't have that rapport yet. And by the way, that relationship's got to go both ways. I mean, there are clients where you may really want to be in that relationship and you want to, you know, I always say, you know, I always tell advisors, every one of your clients, you should feel like they're your friend and vice versa. Because friends call each other all the time, not when there's just an appointment. Right. You know, I don't check in with my friends every quarter or do an annual review with my friends. I'll call them spontaneously. And that those are the best relationships is when it happens. And when you it doesn't even feel like it's happening. It truly is a relationship. And sometimes we got to be honest with ourselves and say, you know, I am working my tail off on this relationship and I'm just not feeling the same level. Maybe this isn't the right relationship. And that happens both ways.
Yeah.
No, right? Clients may be working their tail off and you're just like, I just don't connect with them.
I think we as an industry need to be choosier about who we choose to work with on the front end and who we choose to continue to work with. I absolutely agree. So yeah. I've got a true practice management expert on the line. You've humored me through all of my soft psychological behavioral stuff. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about sort of the meat and potatoes of productivity in an advisor's life. What's one thing, a simple thing, just from a productivity, a time management, et cetera, standpoint that you see advisors failing to do or a place where they're leaving value on the table?
What we always see advisors are doing activities on a weekly basis or in many cases daily basis that is busy work, right? You know, that they're working in the business way too much and not working on the business. And we do a lot of work with advisors where we meet a lot of advisors who have thriving businesses, but they reach a point where it's just no fun anymore. Like they feel like they're just working way too hard at it. And so we do a couple exercises with them. And so one of the things we do is we have them spend, you know, a handful of minutes and just write down all of the different activities they do on a given week. And that list will get 20 to 30 items long. And then we'll ask them, we'll do like a, you know, four box quadrant deal. And, on the axis are effort and impact. And you're going to have a high impact, high effort, high impact, low effort. And it's impact on the client relationship or the impact you're making. And it's amazing how many of the things advisors spend their time on have a low impact on their client experience or client relationships and have either high effort and something comes to low effort. It's like, you realize like over half of the activities are doing things that are required to kind of run the business, a lot of back office stuff and, you know, trading, rebalancing or a lot of stuff that is keeping the advisor away from FaceTime or phone time or Zoom time with the client, which is where the client sees the value.
I'm a sucker for a simple solution. So I hope every advisor that's listening to this will draw out that quadrant, right? With the two axes, you got impact and effort. What's an example of a commonly seen high effort, low impact behavior? I mean, is this like returning emails or like what?
That's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll see that, you know, they'll spend like an hour a day on just checking emails.
Right.
You know, so that's one, making coffee. Right. Could be one. It's like, really? I mean, first of all, your coffee's horrible. You know, that's not your unique ability. Let somebody else do to make the coffee. Or, you know, I mean, I'll tell you, like, trading portfolios is one. I mean, from a client relationship standpoint, that can be automated.
Yeah.
Right. Or outsourced to, my hunch is most advisors are not the best traders. Right. And they did not get in the, well, maybe that they're stockbrokers, but they didn't probably get in the business thinking, I cannot wait to just trade accounts all day long.
Right.
Right. Yeah. You know, we always ask advice, like when you, before you ever got landed your first client and you were on cloud nine, like, I'm going to be an advisor, you know, and you had that great feeling. What was it that was giving you that feeling? And they almost 100% of the time say talking and helping people navigate complex situations, right? It's being in the moment with the client, you know, having those aha moments where the client realizes that they can see a better path forward or mitigate a huge concern they had in their life. And we're like, okay, if that's where you get your energy and that's where you get that, when you bounce out of the step and you get out of the bed in the morning, how much of your time, what percentage is actually doing those activities? And it's usually like less than a third, because they're doing all these other things of running the business.
Yeah, this is an exercise that I think you could do quarterly, because I think there's so much inertia in our professional lives. There's so much busy work. There's so much putting out fires and things that pass for busyness that are really low impact. So I want to turn to your books now. You have a book called 27 Principles Every Investor Should Know. And I looked over the 27 principles. And of course, us being in the moment that we're in, the one that jumped out at me was that, quote, inflation is a silent lifestyle killer. So, Steve, I paid $3 for a Diet Coke this morning, and I felt the lifestyle getting killed. It's never been truer than it is now. And yet it seems hard to know how to combat this at a time when, you know, the future prospects for bonds look shaky. Some parts of the market are steeply valued. How do we combat inflation at a time like this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know it's on a lot of people's minds, and I don't know if this would be a good answer or not, but things like this, this is where I get concerned with our industry, right? Because we react to today's moment and then we start making changes based on what's happening right now. And, you know, like the topic of inflation, the best time to address it is when you first had a plan, right? We know that inflation will happen. It'll be up, it'll be down. You know, we know everything in the market's going to happen. There's going to be bad events. There's going to be downturns. There's going to be upturns. You don't know when it's going to happen, but you know, the markets are complex for a reason, and it all starts with do you have a plan? And so on the topic of inflation, you know, if you had a plan, the best recipe for inflation is to be diversified, right? You need to be diversified in equity markets and fixed income markets, in having cash in your portfolio. Personally, our firm, you know, we highly recommend high quality short term fixed income. Reason for that is we want something always in the portfolio that's stable, because we know equity markets are going to go down at times. And when your client needs money, they got to pull it out of there. And the nice thing about high quality short term, it's you always have something that's maturing. So as rates rise, you're maturing something at a lower rate and you can reinvest it at a bond at a higher rate. Now, when you get long-term bonds, that's when you get, you know, you're going to sell and you're going to have it, you know, probably a loss or a downturn in order to buy that higher rate. So it's having a plan up front, I think, is critical, that addresses the reality that markets are going to happen. Things like high inflation are going to happen, so that when it does happen, you don't panic, right? And you don't make knee-jerk reaction changes to just solve for today's problem, because a year from now, there's going to be something else. So you might solve for and change your portfolio now for inflation, then it's not ready for the next one. So is there a portfolio that, you know, or a strategy, and we just being overly diversified, or I mean, not overly, just be diversified. You know, I think you can be under diversified and be ready for all these things. And then when it does happen, like inflation, there's really only the one thing you can do, right? Manage your budget, right? So there's always times where you're like, yeah, I guess we're going to, You know, we're not going to grab the $3 Coke or the $6 Starbucks. You know, we're going to brew that coffee and it's going to taste a little different today.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard to know. There was an article that came out recently that was like just giving all of these suggestions about what people should do to combat inflation. And I mean, a lot of it came down to spend less money, you know, eat worse food, make your coffee at home. And the reaction to it was violent. Nobody wants to hear these things. And yet, you know, once you have a plan and once you're well diversified, I don't know that there's much else that can be done.
Yeah. And again, going back to the book, you know, so the 27 principles, I think that principle is called plan for inflation. I mean, if every good investor and every good advisor should be telling their clients, inflation will happen. I mean, not mentioning it or not saying that there will be periods of high inflation is a breach of your fiduciary obligation. I mean, everything can't be Pollyanna, right? You're going to have times like this, and we can control how we act during it. And there's not always going to be a quick fix just to give you more money today that you can keep buying that, you know, $3. Where'd you get a $3 Coke at, by the way?
Panera. We're naming and shaming. We're naming and shaming Panera. Do better. I like to go.
That's unlimited. It's unlimited, right? So you can go back all day. I hope.
I don't know, man. I like to go there and just look at a different set of walls sometimes.
Right.
Not for $3. I don't like it. I don't like it that much.
Yeah.
The final question, another one of your 27 principles is that we should have an investment philosophy and follow it. My friend and fellow behavioral guy, Dan Egan, has this great blog post about how investors need a faith. Basically, all the faiths don't have to be the same, right? Like your faith could be different than my faith, but we need something to believe in because otherwise we have sort of a scattershot approach. We have an ever-changing approach that's subject to the whims of the market. So I love this. I love this advice to get an investment philosophy. I think to the average investor, though, it might feel a little overwhelming. Where would someone who is new to capital markets begin to construct an investment philosophy that suits them and their personality?
Yeah, it's a critical step of any successful investor is because things change and things happen in the moment. You got to have something you always fall back on and say, does this event reconcile with my philosophy? And do I need to change my philosophy? Or I think any good strategy has to be based on something sound. So I think if someone was looking, how do they come up with their investment philosophy? And there's a handful of questions. Just to take some basic ones on just an investment, let's use some like our investment tenets that we go off of, right? So diversification. I mean, you could ask, a client should ask themselves, do I want to be more diversified or less diversified? Right. So if you're someone that wants to be less diversified, it's going to take you down a path that'll help you pick something. If you're going to be more diversified, take you down a different path. Right. Maybe you're more of a market-based index strategy type versus a tactical, you know, market timing stock picker approach. Do you believe that risk and return are related? Right. I mean, that's a great question. Again, your answer to that question is going to take you down a path. Do you believe or do you want to pay more or less to own your investments? Right. So again, your answer is going to take you down a path. Do you want to pay more or less in the taxes you pay along the way of owning your investments? Like the answer to these questions is going to take you down a path, which ultimately will become the foundation of your investment philosophy. Right. So imagine if your answer was, I want to be more diversified. I believe risk and return are related. I want to, you know, pay as little as possible to own my investments. I want to pay at least my taxes. And you have a thing, you know, a market event comes along and, you know, there's an advisor or your brother-in-law says, oh, you really need to buy X, Y, and Z, right? And you're like, oh, really? Okay. You run that investment criteria by your deal, right? So the expense ratio is what? 1.6%? Wow. Okay. That doesn't fit my belief system for investing. The turnover is, you know, 220%. Wow, that could generate a lot of taxes, you know, or it only owns 25 different holdings. Ooh, that doesn't fit my philosophy, right? So I think that those are things. As it relates to like, you know, unique personalities, I don't think personality has any anything to do with your investment philosophy. I think you can be a charismatic, outgoing person. You can be an introverted, quiet, you know, self-reflecting person. And I think that actually what people see, that personality, isn't always what you think internally. Right. I heard this story once about a Reggie White, one of the probably the best defensive football players maybe of all time. Right. Probably in the Pro Bowl. He played for the Green Bay Packers. And I mean, he was a ruthless defender. Right. Sack, you know, like what, you know, sack artist and whatnot. And there's a story that Steve Young shared where, you know, he would, you know, Steve Young was a quarterback for the Niners and for many years. And Reggie White would, you know, just ferociously tackle him. And then he'd pick him up, you know, by the hand and go, "Hey, Steve, how's your wife doing?" Like in a second was a terror, you know, just terrorizing him. Then the switch flipped and he's like the nicest. And the word has it, Reggie White's one of the nicest people ever, but you wouldn't know it if you watched his football clips. So I think, you know, there's a deep down, you know, what is your philosophy? And that doesn't always sync with what people think you are, or what they see you as. And I would say, I would argue that most people probably have more of a similar a philosophy on life, or in this case, investment philosophy. But you wouldn't know that on the exterior, what you see every day from those people.
Yeah, it's a great way to take a lofty idea like an investment philosophy, which can seem sort of hard to get your arms around. It really boils down to a handful or two handfuls of questions. I think you did a nice job of outlining them there. Once you know those answers, you're led down a path and you just stick with it in good times and bad. You know, Jim O'Shaughnessy, who wrote What Works on Wall Street, is a former guest on the show. You know, we talked about, I asked him about, he's had this, you know, incredible career, you know, extremely successful career, great author. And I said, "What's your proudest moment professionally?" And he said, "Sticking with my investment philosophy during the great financial crisis, when effectively 2/3 of other quantitative managers deviated from theirs." So yeah. Find yourself a philosophy that works, that's scientific and consistent with your values, and stick with it in good times and bad. So Steve, you have lived up to your lofty billing. Congratulations. You are an excellent guest. If people want more of this excellence, where can they find your work, listen to your podcast, read your books? Where can we find you?
Well, I appreciate the excellent title. I'm not going to claim it though. So I appreciate the using that word, but so I'm not going to you know, say that if you follow, you'll get excellent ideas, but you'll at least get a perspective. And I think that's all we can provide is some, you know, planning ideas and perspective on things. And so there's a few areas you mentioned. You're grateful enough to mention the 27 Principles Every Investor Should Know book. I think that's, and by the way, I didn't really write that. It was more of a compilation of ideas that were created by many other people. They get a lot of, they're all giving credit in that book that, you know, if this business is about distilling complex things into simple terms, this book is an under an hour read, or visuals, there's pictures. So things like, the 27 principles. I am the host of the Admired Advisor podcast, which you mentioned as well. I think we've had over 50 episodes now, and we highlight a different advisor doing something unique from a behavioral standpoint as it relates to the relationships they have. And then, through various industry conferences or the Buckingham Strategic Partner conferences and study groups, that's where I'm usually at, talking to advisors and just facilitating those conversations.
All right. Go check it out. He won't tell you it's excellent, but I will. Thank you again, Steve, for being here.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate being on.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.